dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The election season is getting underway in earnest, and the media, corporate and otherwise, will be full of the platforms of parties, the sound bites of candidates, the pundits, pollsters, and so on. What won't be on the table is the question of whether we even want the sort of society that the candidates are vying to lead. What won't be on the ballot is the question of the powerlessness of most people over the fundamental social structures that shape our lives. This week and over the coming weeks and months, I'm going to read you a brilliant but little-known book that a listener brought to my attention that takes on those questions. It's called Power and Powerlessness, and the author is Susan Rosenthal, a physician and psychotherapist who reached the conclusion after decades of research, observation, and activism that social power is necessary for human health. Her book deals with four basic questions. What's going on? How did this happen? Why do we put up with it? And what will it take? Normally in media, an interviewer reads a book, then elicits from the author a sense of what the book is about for the audience who have not read it. I'd like to do something different. After we've all read the book together, I'd like to interview Dr. Rosenthal and put to her my questions and yours based on our reading. So as we go forward, if you have questions you'd like me to ask her on your behalf, email them to me through the link on the website at unwelcomeguests.org. Along with the readings, I'll be playing material that resonates with the ideas the book addresses, as I have in past readings. Everything I play for you on the show, I believe, contains information or ideas worthy of your attention, but it's seldom that I can say of a speaker, "This person speaks for me." I'll begin the show this week with just such a person. He is writer and DIY activist Chris Carlson. He was interviewed earlier this summer by Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio in Seattle.
Chris Carlson is a writer, publisher, editor, community organizer, and executive director of the Multimedia History Project Shaping San Francisco. For the last 25 years, his activities have focused on the underlying themes of horizontal communications, organic communities, and public space. He was one of the founders, editors, and frequent contributors to the groundbreaking San Francisco magazine Processed World. He also helped launch the monthly bike-ins known as Critical Mass that have spread to five continents and over 300 cities. He has edited four books, Bad Attitude, the Processed World Anthology, Reclaiming San Francisco, History, Politics, Culture, co-edited with James Brooke and Nancy J. Peters, Critical Mass, Bicycling's Defiant Celebration, and The Political Edge. He published his first novel, After the Deluge, in 2004, a story of post-economic San Francisco in the year 2157. And he is here to talk about his new book, Nowtopia, how pirate programmers, outlaw bicyclists, and vacant lot gardeners are inventing the future today. Chris, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Start out and tell us, what was your motivation in writing Nowtopia?
Well, Nowtopia starts from some of those long list of things you just read off of what I've been doing all these years. And going back to the origins of Processed World, when we were in the financial district in the early 80s, a lot of us were essentially discards and rejects and graduates of liberal arts educations. And what do you basically learn to do in college? You learn how to handle information. And so those of us that needed to find work after we had finished our time in the schools were looking, you know, at what was available in the Bay Area, mostly in the downtown financial district. And we found ourselves handling information in banks and insurance companies and things like that. And it was a very empty experience. And we really weren't office workers or information handlers. We were philosophers or historians or dancers or photographers or gardeners or you name it, a whole bunch of different things. But that's where the money was, and that's how we got our bills paid. And so that starts this experience that really leads directly to Nowtopia, which is that of a bifurcated life, a life in which a great deal of what you do is to take care of paying your bills is a job that you think is essentially worthless, or maybe you find it not so bad. Most of us try very hard to move on from the worst jobs to the better jobs and not find them so terribly onerous, and that's perfectly fine. But if you stop and think about it, most of what we do for jobs are kind of a waste of time. Most of it shouldn't even be done at all. I mean, I think huge areas of the economy, as we call it, it's a strange fiction, it's just us going to work every day. The economy, you know, those activities are ought to stop tomorrow. We'd be better off with banking, insurance, real estate, advertising, military production, the production of bad commodities that break in 6 months or 3 weeks or however long it is. You think of even good jobs like teaching. Now they have all these teachers like essentially in assembly line factories churning kids out to pass tests and have very little to do with teaching them to think or to be fully human or engaged with the world. Although many teachers fight that and are doing a wonderful job of continuing to present a fully integrated education for the kids that are out there. So I salute the teachers. I just recognize that the system in which they're working is really constraining them. Similarly, in medicine, you know, you have doctors and nurses who are, you know, really committed to human well-being and health, and yet most of what they do is serve the needs of insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. So there's a way in which our economy, if you will, has developed so that what we end up doing doesn't serve us. And I argue in my book, Nowtopia, that it's at that point of sale when you're hired. You just lost control over the world. You're not any longer asked, should we do this? How should we do it? Who should we do it with? Why are we doing it? All the basic questions of work are left off the agenda in the United States. In a democratic society, quote unquote, you would think there would be a rather intense discussion about what we do and why we do it. And how do we use what we do to get to the good life? But instead, we're in this society that has fetishized growth and has fetishized economic numbers as though they're some kind of natural phenomenon and they're either healthy or sick, and our rest of our lives suffer or rise based on these numbers, which are actually totally out of kilter to our lived experience anyway. And so we're in this kind of strange world where we want meaning, we want to reconnect to our own talents, our own ability to have artisanal relationships to our creativity, etc. And you're not going to get that in those most jobs. Over the last 30 to 40 years, and then going back even to the early part of the 20th century, most jobs have been made really stupid. Anybody can learn them. You can learn a job in an hour, or maybe a day, maybe a week outside. But that's about it. And most jobs, it's repetitive. It's designed to be that way so that anybody can do them. We human beings are the replaceable parts in the system. And it's very systematically set up that way for a very long time. So when you get to the position where you're looking for work in society and you take a job that sounds like what you thought you were training yourself for, and you find out it's this horrible, empty experience. It's very boring and very repetitive and leads nowhere. And finally, seems kind of pointless to do it in the first place. You're going to find your meaning elsewhere. You're going to find your engagement elsewhere. And Nowtopia is a book about how interesting it is that there is a sort of radical political and work movements, if you will, precisely happening outside of wage labor. It's not about starting unions at your job and trying to get a little bit more money or a little bit better benefits. Of course, people do need to band together where they work and defend themselves from onerous conditions and low pay. But what we see, the sort of agency, the sort of excitement, the energy that people have in life is really where they take it outside of work when they are not in the working class precisely. And I have a very broad definition of working class. Basically, all of us get up every day and go out and work and reproduce this world. And most of us have nothing to say about what it is we do or why we do it. That's the working class. There's a separation of execution from responsibility. It's a very broad understanding of it, much different than the innumerable sociological stratifications that people want to draw. I'm upper, lower, middle class. You know, I'm over here. I'm over there. And, you know, really in our society, middle class has come to denote everybody between the person pushing a shopping cart down the street and the fellow or gal riding in a Learjet, and everybody else is in the middle class. So it's a meaningless concept. And what that served was to divert our attention from what we do to what we own or what we can buy. And our sense of political agency has been changed from what we do all day, our work, to what we do when we're not at work shopping. And that's really, you're supposed to shop well to change the world. And this is a big part of the political movements of the last 20, 30 years. It's like, oh, if you just make really good decisions as a consumer, you're doing your part. And my argument is that's totally false. You can buy anything you want. It doesn't make any difference at all. Capitalism determines what you can have. And we need to determine what we're doing as human beings. We should decide what's worth doing and how to do it. And we should create the world we want to live in. We could live a great life. Human beings could live really well all across the planet in a state of generalized abundance with enough of everything for everybody, in a sense of, with a real strong sense of ecological sanity and biological coherence, if that was the point of life, if we set ourselves as human beings to that end. But we don't. We accept all these ridiculous categories and fetishistic notions like money, markets, the health of the economy, as though these were something real. They're not real at all. We make them real because we get up and agree to this con game every day. But we could just agree to a totally different game and actually produce the world we want to live in. Of course, you can't jump from one to the other overnight. But we could start talking about it, and that's what this book is really an effort to do.
So the examples in your book are people who are doing what they want, and they're doing so in a cooperative manner?
Yeah, basically people are producing communities as much as they're producing interesting technological alternatives. And, you know, some of them are kind of might seem kind of mundane at first glance. So, for instance, vacant lot gardening is a big part of one big chapter in my book. Another one is what I call the outlaw bicycling subculture. There's also the free bio, the sustainable biofuels movement, which is, you know, the sort of the tinkerer's grail of seeking free fuel. Everybody wants that these days, especially. The enormous amount of free labor that's gone into the internet and into telecommunications in terms of open source and free software development and continues to this day. People have a great motivation to keep creating things that break out of the logic of the market. And all that area is interesting to emphasize because of how much it changes our imagination, especially, you know, here we are in the heart of a major high-tech zone in Seattle area. And, you know, all of us have something free on our computers, usually quite a few things that are free, whether music or software or what have you. And we understand that there's no reason to constrain it. There's generalized abundance. You can make 8 million, zillion, gazillion copies of anything, and it doesn't affect anybody who created it in the first place. So there's no reason not to see the world through this notion of collaborative labor, derivative efforts that base themselves on the shoulders, standing on the shoulders of the people that came before us, and producing beautiful new things from all that cooperative effort. And then it produces a world of abundance. That's a great metaphor for what the whole of life should be like. And so that's one of the things I like about the software movement. I can talk much more in detail about that if you like. But the gardening movement's an interesting one because it represents something of a reclaiming of the commons. And people went, you know, you go back to World War II. I can back up even further, but I'll just start it there. You know, we had this big victory gardens movement in the United States instigated by the federal government because they wanted people to grow more food to help the war effort. And everybody, you know, for a great number of people, that was how they could contribute, was by growing food. And by the end of World War II, 45% of the fresh produce consumed by Americans was growing in urban gardens. So when we think about a kind of a systematic transition toward a more relocalized life in which we produce the things we need locally amongst ourselves and practical things like food and energy and transportation and communications is really what I'm talking about here. The food model of having, think of cities as urban food forests. They could be. We could actually probably top that 45% number if there was a, you know, kind of like a let's go to the moon type mentality about let's grow food in cities. Now, where would we do that? In vacant lots? I mean, that's where the movement starts, is vacant, you know, People's Park in 1969 in Berkeley. One of the first things they do after they take this fence down from the university to put up around a lot is they plant a urban organic garden. And that influences people all across the country. And pretty soon you have people doing this in vacant lots all over the place. And it's not new knowledge. It's actually very often connecting to the elders in the community who had already had a great experience of learning about the local ecology, putting their hands in the soil, figuring out what would grow in the specific areas with the specific microclimates and soil conditions and water availability, et cetera. And that knowledge got transmitted across the generations in these gardens. And now you have, from the 70s onward, this proliferation of community gardens all over the major cities of the United States. And back in the East Coast especially, they were really the case where this working class that once existed had been broken down. This is an argument that I make when I present the book, and I didn't really lay it out yet here. But part of the frame of reference is this notion of class composition. So you have this working class that had existed that we all kind of remember. Oh, yeah, that's when people all worked in factories and lived in the same neighborhoods, and you had these kind of intact communities. Now we live this totally fragmented and atomized life in which everybody's moving all the time, either moving from job to job or home to home. And there's not that sense of stability, and there's not that sense of knowing each other. And if you want to talk about sort of, you know, movements for serious political change in our culture, you really need to have stable communities that know each other and trust each other so they can envision it from below. It can't be something just imposed from on high. And so this breakdown in the working class left a bunch of things behind, which was destroyed communities and urban life in back east. There was these giant riots in the late 60s, and they burned down parts of the cities. And then the landlords burned down other parts of the cities. And the city's administrations in New York and Detroit and Philadelphia and places like that abandoned whole areas out of this sort of spatial deconcentration and you know, racism and other obvious factors. And so the people left behind, oftentimes, you know, women-centered communities slowly but surely start to rebuild their sense of community life. And one of the ways they did that was by invading these empty lots that had been abandoned that were full of needles and broken glass and cement and rubble, and clearing them and realizing this is a great space for a garden, for a space for our kids to play, but we have to clear it out. So they would spend a lot of, you know, community would come together to do that. They would plant beautiful flowers and trees, and then they would start thinking of, they could grow food there, and people would meet there across generations and across ethnicities and across different musical tastes and all sorts of different things. And then you have these amazing thriving spaces. And they really proliferated. You had over 1,000 of them just in New York City. In San Francisco, we have about 120. You know, there's huge areas of Detroit now that are under the control of what's called the Detroit Agricultural Network, and they're actually farming with tractors because there's so much empty land there. And Philadelphia has another, you know, 900 gardens and so on. And you can just find this story in every city. And in these gardens, then, you have these new communities, and you have people actually thinking about food security and really producing things for their own needs. And something really beautiful starts to happen with that. And then, unfortunately, there's the underside of this story, which is private property, because finally these vacant lots are not common lands. They're actually owned by somebody usually. Either the cities repossess them and are waiting for somebody to develop them into tax-producing revenue streams, or they're privately owned, and the private owners eventually come back and go, wow, thank you for starting this beautiful garden and bringing the neighborhood back from the brink. Now I can sell this, or I can turn it into a spot for, this is great. The neighborhood's gentrifying. My land's gone way up in value. Thank you so much. I'll take it back now. And if you haven't, taken the opportunity when it was worth nothing to really get ownership over it and actually end ownership over it, that is to say, put it into the public commons through either a land trust scenario or public ownership or something, well, you lose. And that's what happened to a number of gardens, although by no means all of them in New York City. A recent case in L.A. happened. A 300-acre garden down in L.A. across from a food bank was repossessed by the owner through some shenanigans with city council down there. And, you know, many families who were living off the food they were growing in this huge garden were dispossessed of it. So this happens again and again if we don't take seriously the underlying dynamic around the question of the commons, which is private property. Now, one of the things I like to emphasize is there's a huge amount of common land in every city that people don't really recognize it as such, because it's covered in asphalt and it serves one basic purpose, which is to house private automobiles and occasionally move them. And that's an absurd use of public space, absolutely absurd. It's a really inefficient and poorly thought out use of urban infrastructure and urban space. So at least as a starting point, I think one of our next tasks is essentially to reassert some control over that common space and for other purposes than merely the shuttling around or parking forever of private automobiles. And instead think of that as the starting point for urban food forests. And what could we grow if we started shrinking streets to half their size? Maybe not every street, but, many of them could be shrunk a lot. And that new space opened up could be the place where people are growing food and planting fruit trees and free fruit in every city. I mean, I was in the city of Belém in the mouth of the Amazon once, and the whole city's full of these magnificent, gigantic mango trees, mangueras. And every day at 3 o'clock with the torrential equatorial rains, all these fresh mangoes fall into the streets. And of course, there's a lot of starving people there. And these little boys who are completely homeless would just run around and grab up all the mangoes. They'd have something to eat. And I think as we go forward in our society with all the obvious crises ahead of us, with water, fresh water issues, with arable soil issues, with crashing availability of energy, et cetera. And I'm not a catastrophist. I don't think all this stuff's happening overnight, and I don't think it's going to happen in a way that we can't ameliorate it and move forward in interesting ways together. It seems like a pretty good idea to start taking some systematic action towards relocalizing food production as much as we could, including in cities.
would seem also America's love affair with lawns, you know, and the integration of those as a, you know, as part of parks. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of that space is just given over to, you know, a monoculture.
Yeah, and it's, you know, lawns that require huge amounts of chemicals to keep them so pristine and strange looking. So, you know, I think everybody enjoys a little bit of lawn once in a while, and there's no reason to say all lawns have to be abolished. But to the notion that most space, you know, in suburbia and in major parks is given over to the European lawn, it's kind of bizarre, and I think we could definitely make better use of that land.
It was also intriguing. I got to visit Norway and Finland just a couple of years ago, and the roofs they have on some of the houses there where they have, you know, sod going mm-hmm. up a couple feet and stuff growing on that, and primarily used for heating, you know, a buffer, insulation. But I was looking at that thinking, God, you could be growing stuff that you could be eating up there.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people talking about that in New York and in San Francisco, too, about starting really – look at all that acreage, just empty rooftops that could be made into thriving farms as well. They actually have bee farmers on the top of houses in Lower East Side of Manhattan now. It's kind of interesting considering that the bee populations are crashing, too.
I wanted to get back to, you mentioned software and the whole mm-hmm. Movement that's happening there. I'm hoping you can expand on that, because that seems to be an area that the corporate America is challenging fairly vigorously.
Well, the open source and free software movements, you know, open source is already essentially a co-optation of the notion of free software, and it was created in order to create some legitimacy in the business world for using this different model of software. So the software world has evolved to a point where it's a little bit like a game of Texas Hold'em, where there's five cards out on the table and everybody knows what they are. That's what all the open source software is. And then the business model says, great, you know, let's do more and more of that, because it erodes the power of Microsoft or other companies that are tended towards monopolization and proprietary control over software. And so there's a move embraced by many, many smaller competitors who see that as a good strategy, as a way of opening up markets and a way of getting more niches in them and so on. And so sure enough, that's happened, and that a great deal of what's been produced in the last 15 years of open source has been paid for by corporations, as it turns out, because they saw that as that was useful to them. But the impetus for it in the first place, and then a great number of people who continue to add on and augment what's out there for us as individuals, are people who have these skills who refuse to reduce themselves to being merely remunerated by money and see themselves as, you know, engaged in a larger process of really trying to open up the world towards this notion of free and creating a spaces in which people can do things without the constraints of corporate domination or, you know, the propagandistic systems we live in or the government telling us what we can do or not do, et cetera. And that kind of impulse has created incredible amounts of resources for all of us to then express ourselves. So lots of us have blogs now, and all of us are posting photos to Flickr and are involved in endless email chats and conversations and, you know, instant messaging, et cetera, all of which has its origins in this kind of effort to create free space and open space. I mean, even the personal computer didn't come out of a corporate plan. It came out of a lot of tinkerers and garages thinking, you know what, there's no reason why we should leave giant corporations and the military to be the only ones having computers. Why don't we get some for the people? And I actually write about this in my chapter about the this group in Berkeley called the Community Memory Project, which I happened to work with back in 1979 and 1980. And they envisioned a great deal of what the internet has come to be in terms of what they thought they were creating. But they didn't believe at that point that there would be a personal computer in everybody's home. They thought that would never happen, and that it would be creating these public computers where you could go and sit in a laundromat or a cafe and have access to everybody else, and then anybody could make the news. This was really the vision, was to change the media from being a couple of voices speaking to millions to being every voice speaking to every other voice. And really, the internet has evolved in that direction in a really interesting way. So there's this kind of open space that's really interesting, and it's still obviously rushing towards a commercialized model and largely commercialized already. But there are a lot of openings and a lot of spaces there that remain inspiring. And one of the things that happens is that a lot of the really talented programmers who are not satisfied with just reproducing profits for capital take their time and their energy outside of the market and produce really interesting tools for social movements. So one example I have in the book is this guy, Guillermo Payet, who was a Peruvian programmer who came up to do a work for IBM and then worked for .com startup that he had, and then it crashed like everything. And while he was doing that, in his spare time and with his people that he was working with, he kind of encouraged them to help, and they were happy to do it. They started something called localharvest.org, which you can check out. And it's a system that creates that's a software tool for farmers, for small growers, and who are doing artisanal production and have old heirloom strains of fruits and vegetables. And things that for which there's not a large market, and if they have to put it into the normal agribusiness model, they lose. Well, most farmers lose if they deal with agribusiness anyway. And so he created a system whereby they could connect directly with people who are interested in what they're growing and their markets without any middleman. And it was totally free on his part to create this resource. And he did it because he cared about good food. He comes from Peru, and they had good food, and he lived in Silicon Valley, and they don't have good food. And he was really upset by that, and he wanted to figure out, how could I get connected to the local food systems and make it so that they can sustain themselves? And in some ways, he's very parallel to the slow food movement, which in the United States takes the form of essentially wealthy people indulging in foodie kind of politics and events, spending lots of money on expensive things. But it has its origins in real working class efforts in Italy and other parts of Europe to save the old ways of doing things, to save the old ways of making a certain sausage or a certain cheese, or having this old orchard of pears that are totally heirloom that nobody remembers, and bringing them back to life, but bringing them to the market. And it's kind of an irony for somebody like me who wants to overthrow markets and money to talk about these systems that essentially allow farmers to get money for their various limited production of sort of glamorous small things, you know, whatever they might be. But it's the point being that we're living in a world that's really destroying the biodiversity, not only of the general ecology of the planet, but specifically of agriculture. There used to be hundreds, in some cases thousands, of varieties of apples and pears and peaches and all these things, and now we're down to two or three or four. And that's very unsafe in the long term for the human species, and probably for the planet to have reduced biodiversity that way. So this slow food movement understands that to combat that, you actually have to create markets for these small heirloom vegetables and fruits, because otherwise the farmers won't keep them going. So there's an interesting thing about sort of using the mechanisms in the short term as we move to a long-term society that's based on much greater diversity and much greater abundance.
So what do you say to people to get them moving in this direction that are, you know, basically bound by the current system that have to, you know?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. We all do. We all are bound, right? I have bills to pay. I have to earn some money somehow. And so we all find what we can do, the best compromise we can make. And my little mantra on that is better than worse. You know, try to find something that's better rather than the thing that's worse. Try to make a better decision rather than a worse decision about at every moment where you have a choice. And, you know, if you're caught up in a world in which you're working three jobs to get by, you probably don't have a whole lot of time to do anything else. If you're working in one job where you get enough money from it, you probably can take some time to do other things as well. And a lot of what we do nowadays is we help each other steal time from our jobs. Like if we're at a big corporation especially, there's a lot of space usually to get away with things, whether it's having time for chatting with your friends on the phone or on the computer or messing around on the internet, or more practically writing a book or, you know, creating new projects that you're working on in your spare time, but then you can bring that into your work life as well. So there's ways you can start to divert resources, really importantly, from the kind of things we do for money. So there's all these little things you can do around that. Then there's also the time when we're not at work, which for many of us is, you know, different sizes of different availabilities and different amounts of energy that we have left over after we've earned our money. But in those other spaces is where I think people have been really innovative and interesting. And it's precisely when they're not being paid and when they're not working class, not reproducing capitalism on its own terms, that they're inventing all these new ways of doing things. And so the gardening movement was one example. Another really good example is the bicycling movement. I mean, bicycling's just expanded like crazy since the early 90s. And one of the reasons was Critical Mass, which I was part of the group of people who started the first one back there in San Francisco. But that's not the whole story. Critical Mass does create this amazing experience where you have hundreds, dozens, thousands of bicycles rolling through the streets together, reoccupying urban space, the city streets, for a completely different purpose, in which people are talking to each other and they're hearing the bells tinkling and they're having this different auditory experience. They're smelling the world differently. They're seeing the world differently. And they're talking to each other. I mean, how many places in the United States do people just talk to each other for the sheer joy of meeting somebody new and talking to them? It's almost always in a bar or a restaurant or some version or another where you buy something to be there. And if you're not buying something, you have no purpose to be there. And so our lives have been reduced to endless streams of commercial transactions. And Critical Mass was an example of people coming together on the bicycle with a different idea about public space and a different idea about what it is to be cohabitants of an urban environment. And so, you know, obviously some people don't like it and have their criticisms of it, and that's fine, and I'd be happy to talk about that with anybody. But for purposes of this discussion, the interesting thing about critical mass is it's kind of a launching pad. It's a place where people networked and met each other in this free space with a new sense of what's possible about moving your body through the city, a new sense of how cities could be. And one of the most interesting things about all these initiatives in Nowtopia is how much it changes people's imaginations, how they think about what might be and what's possible. And so in the case of the bicycling movement, tons of women have been involved. There's all these bike zines going on. There's all these crazy cultural bike rides. I know just here yesterday in Seattle, you had a naked bike ride and people painted themselves quite beautifully. There, you know, all these, well, I saw quite a few people like that over the course of the day in this place I was at. And then finally, you have the rise of the what's known as the DIY bike shop. And DIY, I'll just say a little bit behind that, too. You know, the DIY bike shop is basically a place where you go with your bicycle and you say, you know, my bike's, I got a flat or my brakes are broken. Can you fix them? They look at you like, no, we don't fix bikes here. Sorry. But we'll show you how to fix your bike. And here's the tools and here's the stand and here's how you do it. And if you need me to stand next to you the whole time and help you do it, I'll do that. So there's a systematic community building thing going on around these DIY bike shops, and it's around the transfer of technological knowledge. It's around using the waste stream of wasted parts and broken bicycles that are endlessly thrown away on the curb by Americans who just think of them as toys and junk. And there's all these people who recognize, no, this is a huge transportation infrastructure at our disposal, really. It's being disposed of, but let's take it out of that stream. And instead of putting it in the landfill, let's reuse these things. And you have at least one or more of these bike shops that have emerged in almost every city in the United States in the last 10 years, mostly run by volunteers. There's very few people even getting wages out of these things, although one of their dramas is that as they succeed and they become more stable over time, then the normal problems of a small business begin to beset them with, you know, rent and wages and so on. But in any case, the bicycling movement's been one of the more interesting areas of expression of this DIY impulse. And the DIY, you know, obviously it can be reduced to this simple action of just fixing it yourself or doing your own gardening or what have you. But the deeper impulse of DIY is the refusal of corporate and governmental expertise and saying that what they tell us is not necessarily true at all. In fact, it's very often blatantly false. So one of the interesting examples of this going back in our recent history is the women's health movement, because women got together and started organizing themselves for their own health when they realized that normal mainstream medicine was just not going to meet their needs. And so now you have all these women's health clinics all over the country. This goes back to the 60s and 70s, you know, the rise of the legal right to abortion, the self-care around, you know, reproductive health. All these things are phenomena of a DIY movement of women for their own health care. Another great example, which we now have to reinvent, is the anti-nuclear movement. The nuclear was presented to everybody as though it was a fait accompli and there was no way around it and it was the obvious solution for all of our problems. Now they're talking that way again, but there's a whole lot of us out here, millions of us who know better and who spent a lot of time in the 1970s finding out that nuclear was a ridiculous way of boiling water. And there's a lot more efficient ways of producing the energy needs that we have before us. And so nuclear, you know, becomes a disaster on a bunch of different levels. And the kind of DIY sensibility that informed that was partly because we taught ourselves and we had all these study groups and affinity groups and direct action groups and so on that really developed the knowledge of what the real issues were around energy production and energy consumption, for that matter. But then also a number of people dropped out of the professional world. And we have this anti-professionalism phenomenon, which there you can find in every field, where people who are skilled and well-trained join the opposition. And realize that by going out and just keeping their mouth shut and doing their job and working for capital, they're actually causing many more problems than they can possibly justify to themselves. And instead, they take that time and technological expertise and contribute it to social movements who are in opposition to the agenda being presented from on high. So these are kind of examples of a DIY. We just had this in the Bay Area. They were going to spray the whole area for brown apple moths. An incredible social movement erupted in less than the last 3 months, and that they've just announced that they're not going to spray. And it's because so many people were up in arms about it and pushing back against it, even though they claimed it was totally safe. But people figured out that it wasn't. So this kind of DIY impulse, I think, is a really important part of our lives that we have to honor and expand.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. Talking with Chris Carlson, he is author of the new book, Nowtopia. And in addition to your book, do you have a website people can go to?
Yeah, my website. I have one under my name, which leads to everything else. It's chriscarlson.com, and Carlson spelled with two S's. There's also nowtopia.org, and you can get the book at akpress.org.
Chris Carlson, interviewed by Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio. For the remainder of the program, I'm going to read to you from Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. Introduction. Their power, our powerlessness. Our power, their powerlessness. Each calls the other into being. The world is a puzzling place. Like Alice in Wonderland, people rush to go nowhere. Too many things don't make sense, and the threat of losing one's head is ever present. It seems as if humanity has fallen down the rabbit hole and cannot find a way out. Yet, there is hope. If we can understand how we got here and what keeps us here, we can go forward. Society is divided into two groups of people, a few who wield immense power and the rest who feel varying degrees of powerlessness. As a result, conflicts over power dominate life. Between individuals, the struggle for power kills intimacy. On a social level, competition drives down living standards. On a global scale, the battle for dominance threatens human survival. Power over others and lack of power are both corrupting. However, power, the ability to control events, can also liberate. Power is not the problem. The problem is unequal access to power. For more than 100,000 years, our ancestors lived in cooperative, power-sharing societies. This book explains how the rule of reciprocity was overthrown and how it can be reestablished. My experience as a physician compelled me to write this book. As the sister of a disabled child, I thought the doctors had the power to end suffering, and I wanted that power. After I graduated from medical school, I learned how powerless doctors actually are. Most of my patients' problems were rooted in family dynamics, financial difficulties, and conflicts at school and at work. I studied psychotherapy in the hope that combining mind and body skills would be more useful. It was. I could help people move from uncommon misery to common misery. The problems created by alienation, oppression, and exploitation remained beyond my control. After listening to thousands of people's stories, I have concluded that social power is necessary for human health. Most people lack the happy, healthy, fulfilling lives they deserve because they are kept powerless and mistakenly accept this state of affairs as natural or self-inflicted. In fact, most human suffering is preventable. This book reveals what must be done. Part 1 explains that society does not arise from human nature. On the contrary, current social arrangements violate human nature. Part 2 shows how power is divided by class. Part 3 investigates how power and powerlessness are perpetuated. Part 4 reveals how powerlessness can be transformed into power. Knowing that the material in this book would be controversial, unbelievable to some, I carefully referenced every fact, every quote, and every contentious statement. To my dismay, the final draft contained more than 1,400 references spanning 70 pages. To make the book shorter and more affordable, I cut out most of those references. However, I will be happy to provide specific references on request. A just world is possible. Human beings create society, and we can change it. The need for change is urgent. Everywhere there is injustice, anguish, and anger. This book explains how society shapes people, how people shape society, and how powerlessness can be converted into power to transform the world. Part 1 of Power and Powerlessness. Many Americans we know are horrified by the posture of their government, but seem to be helpless. Harold Pinter. The 21st century is young and already drips with blood. Washington has launched wars against Afghanistan and Iraq and backed Israel to destroy Lebanon. When Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, the most powerful government in the world abandoned its poor to die. Ordinary Americans have lost jobs, pensions, and health care, while oil profiteers reap billions in tax cuts. Secret prisons, systematic torture, and domestic spying confirm the corruption at the heart of the system. Why is this happening? The usual explanations blame human nature as if nothing can be done. The inability to change society is an extension of the powerlessness that most people feel every day at the hands of supervisors, bosses, and bureaucrats, at home, at school, in the market, on the street, and at work. How can justice be achieved when so many people feel powerless in so many ways? Do we have the world we deserve, or is there another explanation? Part 1 addresses these questions. Chapter 1, Does Anybody Really Care?, provides evidence that people do care about one another. Chapter 2, Compassion Isn't Cost-Effective, shows how capitalism blocks compassion. Chapter 3, Who Needs a Heart When a Heart Can Be Broken?, explains how dissociation helps people endure what they cannot change. Chapter 4, Nature's Youngest Child, reveals how capitalism prevents people from solving social problems. Chapter 1, Does Anybody Really Care? Bill Moyers recalls looking at photos of his grandchildren and thinking, we are stealing their future, betraying their trust, despoiling their world. And I ask myself, why? Is it because we don't care? Because we are greedy? Because we've lost our capacity for outrage, our ability to sustain indignation at injustice? What has happened to our moral imagination? Such questions demand answers. Every day, crowds of people stream past homeless beggars. Few respond to their pleas for help. One cold Christmas morning, I watched two men walk up to a bank machine. A homeless woman lay sleeping in front of it. They stepped over her to withdraw some money, and as they turned to leave, stepped back over her without interrupting their conversation. Events like these reinforce the belief that people are naturally selfish and that social problems result from original sin or human nature. Is this true? Let's examine the evidence. Are people heartless? A poster campaign to raise money for charity shows a half-naked toddler sitting in a pile of garbage with the caption, "How young do they have to be before we give a damn?" The poster implies that people are so indifferent to suffering that they must be shocked or shamed into caring. In fact, people are not indifferent at all. Over 70% of Americans think that the government should ensure that no one goes without food, clothing, or shelter. People also dig into their own pockets to help. The Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies raised over $1 billion U.S. dollars in 1 month to aid the victims of the 2004 Asian tsunami. 85% of this money was contributed by the general public. Prisoners donated their wages, and the homeless emptied their pockets. Of the $250 billion donated to American nonprofit organizations in 2004, less than 5% came from corporations, while more than 75% came from individuals. People show their concern for others every day. Most people prefer to go to work sick than stay at home and increase the burden on their coworkers. Employers literally bank on the altruism of employees. Hospitals and schools are underfunded in the knowledge that workers will expend extra energy to fill the gap. Nearly 55% of people working in medicine and education contribute unpaid overtime, and more than half take work home. People commonly put others' needs before their own. A survey of male and female caregivers of women with advanced breast cancer found that 5% had quit their jobs or turned down a job promotion in order to provide care. 69% had missed days at work, reduced their work hours, and used holidays or taken special leave to support their loved ones. Many of these caregivers suffered anxiety and depression. Despite the strain on their jobs, finances, and health, they reported being very satisfied with their choice to put caregiving first. In everyday human interactions, people who are caring and compassionate are highly valued. Are people lazy? Some say that more people don't protest injustice or support social causes because they are lazy. If that were true, there would be no volunteers. Over 80 million Americans donate 20 billion hours of their time every year volunteering in hospitals, hospices, nursing homes, fire departments, rescue squads, shelters, halfway houses, counseling services, and church programs. This does not include the many hours that people spend helping family, friends, and neighbors. If people were lazy, no one would participate in bike-a-thons, walk-a-thons, and other fundraising events for charity. If people were lazy, no one would campaign for civil rights or build a union. If people were lazy, they would do nothing after work instead of playing sports, fixing cars, gardening, dancing, painting, and making things for their children. If people were lazy, then the jobs that demanded the least work would be the most desirable. In reality, having nothing to do makes people feel useless. Human beings have a strong need to contribute, and many seniors seek work after retirement for that reason. Do people have it too good? Some complain that most people are too well off to rock the boat. A few people do benefit from how things are and don't want anything to change. However, most people's living standards are falling. In 2003, the United Nations found that living standards in more than 50 countries had declined over the previous 10 years. The World Health Organization estimates that, quote, more than 2.6 billion people, about 40% of those on the planet, have no access to basic sanitation or adequate toilet facilities. More than a billion people have no access to clean water sources, and an estimated 4,000 children die every day from illness caused by lack of safe water and sanitation. In rich nations, falling living standards can be seen in the increase in part-time and contract jobs, longer working hours, fewer benefits, rising debt, loss of social supports, more stress, and more poverty. In America's Forgotten Majority, Why the White Working Class Still Matters, Roy Teixeira and Joel Rogers found that a 50-year-old white male high school graduate earned between $2,000 and $3,000 a year less in 1996 than he would have earned 10 years earlier. From 1973 to 1998, in an economy that almost doubled in real terms, the wage of the typical worker in production and non-supervisory jobs, 80% of the workforce, actually declined by 6%, from $13.61 to $12.77 an hour. Based on a 40-hour week, this turns out to be a loss of about $1,750 a year for the typical worker. Close quote. In the world's richest nation, more than 11% of households have difficulty putting food on the table. More than 45 million Americans cannot afford medical insurance. 28% of uninsured adults with serious medical problems cannot afford to buy the medicines they need. More than 40% of working Americans have medical debts, and half of all personal bankruptcies are health-related. With living standards declining for so many people, we can't explain low levels of social protest on people having it too good. Are people ignorant? It is commonly thought that if enough people knew what was going on, they would never put up with it. This belief motivates some people to dedicate their lives to revealing the truth. Since the 1970s, Dr. Helen Caldicott has campaigned to educate the public about the dangers of nuclear power. Over the same period, Dr. Samuel Epstein has thoroughly documented how industrial pollution causes cancer. Countless others have exposed how the drive for profit creates needless misery for human beings and destroys the environment. These messages have found an audience. Most Americans think business leaders and politicians are corrupt and self-serving, and 86% want stricter laws and regulations to protect the environment. In 2004, Michael Moore's anti-war movie, Fahrenheit 9/11, broke the record for the largest grossing documentary ever. By mid-2005, the majority of Americans believed that the U.S. had launched its war against Iraq on false pretenses, that the president and his advisors had lied to the country, and that the war was not worth it. Yet the president remained in office, and the war continued. Most people do know what is going on. They may not know all the details, but they know the basics. That the world is run for the rich and powerful at the expense of everyone and everything else. If the truth alone could change the world, it would have changed by now. Later chapters will explain how society is structured to keep most people feeling powerless most of the time, regardless of what they know. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. To care is human. People show kindness and caring every day. We help each other with directions, adopt stray animals, return lost objects, and comfort each other in hard times. Such considerations are ignored by a media machine that provides us with a daily diet of assault, child abuse, murder, war, and other atrocities. Sometimes the generosity of ordinary people does hit the news. On 9/11, firefighters raced into the burning World Trade Center with no thought for their own safety and died when the towers collapsed. The bridges to Manhattan were clogged with people rushing downtown to help. Construction workers left their jobs to search for survivors, and volunteers lined up to give blood. Dr. Robert Jones, director of New York City's Blood Services, described how, quote, within an hour of the attack, donors appeared, lining up around the block, wanting to donate blood. Even when you tried to explain to blood donors that this was not going to be helpful at this time, they still felt compelled by some social value that they were experiencing to donate at that time. They just had to do it, close quote. The amount of donated blood overwhelmed the system. 500,000 units were collected, while fewer than 260 units were used. That same day, 17 Canadian towns and cities took in almost 34,000 stranded airplane passengers from the United States. When 38 jets were diverted to a small town in Newfoundland, local people opened their hearts, their homes, and their wallets. Striking school bus drivers left picket lines to drive plane loads of passengers to community shelters. Doctors and nurses set up clinics where passengers could get their prescriptions filled, and pharmacies filled them for free. Canadian air traffic controllers cooked massive quantities of chili, bacon, and eggs for the visitors. Northwest Airlines Captain Dan Runick told reporters, I had prepared my passengers to ration their food and their water. For the people of that locale to empty their pantries and open their homes just took everyone by surprise. Why were they surprised? Because, as the next chapter explains, capitalism cultivates callousness and rewards greed. Summary. Social problems cannot be blamed on human nature because people can be caring or cruel in different situations. Nevertheless, pessimistic beliefs about human nature persist because the powers that be promote this view, and people go along because they need some way to explain what is wrong in the world. And I'm reading from Susan Rosenthal's Power and Powerlessness. Chapter 2. Compassion isn't cost-effective. It's time to see the world as it really is. Captain James T. Kirk. During my hospital training, I participated in daily rounds where medical staff moved from room to room assessing the patients. One morning, we examined a 35-year-old woman who was suffering from an advanced liver disease. As the convoy of doctors and nurses turned to leave, the patient cried out, I'm dying! I'm dying! I'm scared! A nurse responded, You're not dying. You're going to be fine. And the group moved to the next room. An hour later, I entered the morgue to find this same patient lying on the autopsy table. I was horrified. When I told his senior doctor what happened, he responded, You'd better get used to it. I got the message. Feelings don't matter here. The patient's fears were disregarded, and she was abandoned to die alone. My shock at what happened to her was considered unworthy of discussion. Medical schools teach students that patients' feelings are important. However, in the real world of the busy hospital, feelings are not cost-effective. When we listen to people and care about how they feel, then we want to provide them with what they need, someone to sit and listen, more detailed explanations, or help with work and family matters. However, there is no profit to be made from providing these services. To maximize productivity, cash-squeezed public hospitals and profit-driven private hospitals treat patients like widgets on an assembly line. Instead of discussing patients by name, medical staff refer to them by diagnosis. The fibroids in room 12 and the pancreatic cancer in room 5, like mechanics working on parts, not people. One psychiatrist describes how compassion is discouraged in his workplace. Quote, "Every few months, all staff psychiatrists receive a compilation of length of stay statistics, savable days, and other related data listed by individual staff member. Through this process, staff are openly ranked according to the speed with which they discharge their patients. The worst offenders, those who keep their patients in hospital the longest, appearing at the top of the list. These reports, masquerading as information, represent an example of public shaming. I wait in vain for rankings of humanistic parameters such as compassion, empathy, and supportiveness toward patients, or even simpler measures such as providing good treatment or treating other staff well." Close quote. The needs of medical staff are no more important than the needs of patients. Hospitals foster a competitive, suck-it-up mentality to squeeze the most work from the fewest people. As a medical intern, I worked between 80 and 120 hours a week. When your own needs are denied, it becomes easier to deny the needs of others. One night, a patient suffered a heart attack. As the team struggled to resuscitate him, I was appalled to find myself hoping that he would die so I could go to bed. I had been on my feet for 30 hours without a break. The typical underfunded hospital demands that medical trainees take on overwhelming workloads, suffer persistent sleep deprivation, and abandon any personal life. Under such conditions, it is not surprising that student doctors finish their training significantly more depressed, more hostile, and less empathetic than when they began. To raise productivity, capitalism glorifies the efficient professional who has no time for feelings. Popular characters like Spock on Star Trek reject emotions as an obstacle to good decision-making. However, morality, ethics, and values are rooted in emotions or gut feelings that move people towards what they believe is right and away from what they believe is wrong. Without emotions, there would be no anger in response to injustice and no shame in behaving badly. Cultivation of the psychopath. If one were to design a human being that was perfectly suited to the capitalist system, that person would be a psychopath. Someone who is disconnected from emotions, having no empathy and no compassion. The American Psychiatric Association defines a psychopath as someone who exhibits, quote, "a pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others, as indicated by three or more of the following. Failure to conform to social norms with respect to lawful behaviors, as indicated by repeatedly performing acts that are grounds for arrest. Deceitfulness, as indicated by repeated lying, use of aliases, conning others for personal profit or pleasure. Impulsivity, or failure to plan ahead. Irritability and aggressiveness as indicated by repeated physical fights or assaults. Reckless disregard for safety of self or others. Consistent irresponsibility as indicated by repeated failure to sustain consistent work behavior or honor financial obligations. Lack of remorse as indicated by being indifferent to or rationalizing having hurt, mistreated, or stolen from another." The documentary film, The Corporation, explains how this definition applies to corporations. Lying, cheating, stealing, hurting people, having a short-term outlook, aggressive behavior, and lack of remorse are standard business practices, making the psychopath the ideal corporate executive. Albert Dunlap, who was described by his biographer as a vicious psychopath, became the darling of the business world during the downsizing frenzy of the 1990s. Dunlap was called Chainsaw Al because he chopped hundreds of thousands of jobs. The more people he laid off, the higher the stock prices climbed. Popular culture presents the psychopath as the villain we love to hate. In the movie Spider-Man, Norman Osborn is a corporate executive whose greed and ambition cause him to develop an evil persona, the Green Goblin. The Goblin is a psychopath who tells Spider-Man, quote, "There are 8 million people in this city, And those teeming masses exist for the sole purpose of lifting exceptional people like us on their shoulders, close quote.